Welcome to the CSIS podcast. I'm Colm Quinn. I hope you enjoyed last week's part one of Destination Maghreb. We'll be back with part two next week, but for now, we're back to the usual run of things. We'll be talking about Venezuela, where President Nicolas Maduro has won a second term.
Gracias por hacerme presidente de la República Bolivariana de Venezuela.
The opposition aren't happy about the results, not least his challenger, Henri Falcon.
We don't recognize this electoral process as valid, as having taken place. For us, there were no elections. New elections in Venezuela need to take place.
Para nosotros no hubo elecciones. Hay que hacer nuevas elecciones en Venezuela.
And Falcon himself was lucky to make it onto the ballot, as other opposition groups were banned from participating in an election that was widely boycotted as Venezuela's economy continues to freefall. But first, to the ever-twisting road of relations between the US and Korea. In the end, it wasn't a tweet, but a letter that's ended hopes of a Trump-Kim summit on June 12th. Secretary of State Pompeo read the letter, addressed to Chairman Kim, to reporters.
I felt that a wonderful dialogue was building up between you and me, and ultimately is only that dialogue that matters. Someday, I look very much forward to meeting you. This missed opportunity is a truly sad moment in history. Sincerely yours, Donald J. Trump, President of the United States of America.
The meeting was highly unprecedented, and perhaps the occasion was too much for both men. I spoke to Victor Cha, a senior advisor and our Korea chair, about why he thinks the talks have faltered.
Ultimately, because he didn't see the forming of a deal that he wanted, that he envisioned coming out of the meeting. It's pretty clear that the North Koreans were unresponsive to various efforts by the administration and their team in preparations for the Singapore summit. And you pair that together with the very negative statements we've heard from the North Koreans last week. That I think they put two and two together and realized that this may not be the time to do it. It's too early. I think the president's letter to Kim Jong-un, which was made public, all of these are very extraordinary things, left the door open, said that it may not be the right time to meet now, but that he's open to meeting in the future. So we'll see if that happens. And I think more importantly, we'll see if this, so we know the summit's been canceled. So the real question is what comes next, right? And I think, on the optimistic side, you can say they can still use the dialogue channels that they have established in preparation for this summit to start trying to continue a negotiation to see if we can get to a point where they feel comfortable putting the summit back on the schedule. That would be a more positive interpretation in the sense that the U.S. and North Korea had never had direct dialogue at a high level before. So that would be a line of communication that could be used.
Do you think this could have been avoided, Victor?
You mean the cancellation?
Yeah.
I could have been avoided if we never agreed to one in the first place. But President Trump, in a very abrupt and spontaneous moment, jumped at the idea of having the meeting. But once we made the commitment and got into the negotiation, I think it was very hard for the United States to pull out. And then Trump just kept raising expectations about the summit to the point where he may have raised them too high for his own good, in the sense that now that he could not meet those expectations, he made the regretful decision to pull out.
In the lead up to this, there was a lot of jockeying within even the administration, John Bolton and Mike Pompeo trying to lead more of a swift denuclearization, which may obviously not be what the North Koreans want. Do we have an idea of what the U.S. wants?
Yeah, I think we want a denuclearization process that is front-loaded, in the sense that we want not just a freeze of their program, but real, deliberate, and permanent efforts to dismantle the programs, ultimately for shipping out of the country. And that's far from what the North Koreans want. The North Koreans look at denuclearization of the entire Korean Peninsula. They see it as a political process rather than a technical process in which They want an end to U.S. hostile policy and attenuation of U.S. alliance commitments and nuclear umbrellas to its allies in the region. At a future point at which they might consider giving up their nuclear weapons. So there was a pretty wide gap between the two sides. I think for experts, experts recognize that gap right away, but it looks like it took, and John Bolton, I'm sure, recognized that right away, but I think it took the president a little bit more time to come to the realization that the North Koreans were not going to behave differently just for him.
And the South Korean president, President Moon, he has hardly put a foot wrong so far in bringing this to the table. This will be kind of a big setback for him. And, you know, he was at the White House on Tuesday trying to smooth things over and get things going. So where does he go from here?
Yeah, so I think this is probably got the South Koreans in a bit of a tizzy. I think they're quite concerned prior to the start of diplomacy, going back to the Olympics, that the situation on the Korean Peninsula was headed in a very bad direction. I'm sure they'll be concerned about that again. But at the same time, I think they're going to continue to try to play a role mediating between the United States and North Korea to see if they can get the diplomacy back on track. South Korean President Moon was just here. I mean, he was here on Tuesday and met with the president. So my guess is that they were also surprised by this announcement, too. They will hope for that this still continues in a positive direction rather than North Korea starting to test missiles again, because they said at the beginning of this whole process they were not going to test as long as everybody was in dialogue. So the danger here is that they may now decide, if dialogue collapses, that they're going to just go back to testing their missiles. Hopefully that won't be the case, because that would take us to a very bad place again.
And it's hard to put a prognosis on this, but how far does this set us back? Months?
Well, I mean, if we look at the challenge coin that they created for the summit, we have until the end of 2018. the coin said 2018. But seriously, you know, I don't think we know just yet. Again, I hope those dialogue channels stay open between the U.S. and DPRK so they can continue to work at an expert level to see if they can close the gap on denuclearization, and that the North Koreans still hold to the testing moratorium so that we don't spiral up into the crises that we had in 2017.
And that was Victor Cha. And now to Venezuela, and to an election the United States has called fraudulent and an attack on constitutional order. On Sunday, Nicolás Maduro was elected president for a second term amid allegations of vote rigging, as well as an opposition boycott. Turnout was low. Official estimates put it at 46.1%, while the opposition say it was as low as 30%. Nonetheless, Maduro triumphed. He received 5.8 million votes over his challenger, Henri Falcón's 1.8 million. I spoke to Moises Rendon. He's an associate fellow in our Americas program and a Venezuelan himself. We talked about the election and the future of his country.
What happened on the presidential elections in Venezuela is anything but a democratic election. The Maduro regime has used state resources, has used propaganda, has used even food and medicine as a tool for political purposes. And that really led to what came as a result in the election.
And what's the state of the opposition right now?
That's a very important driver right now inside of Venezuela. It's divided. It's not as consistent as we used to see it, for example, last year. Venezuela is a multi-party system. There are more than 28 political parties in the opposition only. So it's difficult among the opposition leaders to really have a consistent agenda. And not only today, throughout the history of the country, but especially today when dealing with such a nature of dictatorship as we are with the Maduro regime. And it's more difficult for them to have a consistent voice. And there is not really a leader in the opposition either. So, and it's not on the opposition fault only. I mean, the Maduro regime has really done a good job on dismantling, demobilizing the opposition and their different leaders. Many of them are jailed. Many of them are banned from running to any political position. So it's really a systemic process that has been designed to demobilize the opposition in Venezuela.
And we hear all these statistics about the deterioration of Venezuela, and yet Maduro stays on. So is it the lack of opposition? What is keeping him in power?
There are two main things that are keeping Maduro in power. One is the institutional control that he has. He really controls all the institutions of the country, you name it, the Supreme Court, the police, the military, and the courts. And the health system is controlled by the regime, the education system, everything is really controlled by the regime. And now the even who enacts and makes the laws, the National Constituent Assembly, is now also in control by the regime. So all the institutions are controlled, by including the electoral authority who hosts elections in the first place. But not only that, also Maduro has imposed social control tools, and mainly through food and medicine. Venezuela is a country that has severe food and medicine shortage, and the regime has been using that as a political purpose by creating tools, this called a fatherland car, that is the main way how poor Venezuelans, who is the majority of the country, can get food on the table. So is that's a very important tool that's keeping also Maduro in power, despite the fact that it lacks the popular support that they used to have before.
Speaking of the people of Venezuela, you have been on the ground recently in Colombia, also in Brazil, looking at this migrant crisis, people leaving Venezuela. What's leading to that, and what have you seen?
Yes, so there is a refugee migrant crisis going on that is unprecedented in the region. The Americas has never seen such a crisis in the history of our region before. So there are about 50,000 Venezuelans crossing daily to Colombia. Most of them are just going to get food and medicine and coming back to Venezuela. But about 5,000 of which are staying permanently in Colombia every day. And Brazil has a different scenario. The number is less. It's about 1,000 average a day crossing to Brazil. But the humanitarian risks are similar. And there are two countries that are not prepared to absorb this increasing number of refugees. So that's why the international community is paying more attention, more in Colombia than in Brazil. And that's why we wanted to also go to Brazil to get a sense of what's needed. And there is a lot of needs right now in Brazil as well, in terms of health, in terms of humanitarian aid, in terms of food security. You know, when talking with refugees and migrants on the ground, all they share is that they left the country only just because they couldn't fed themselves in Venezuela and their families. That was the main driver. They left because either hyperinflation or food shortage are just not letting them put food on the table in a daily basis. So they have to really, for survival reasons, they have to leave the country.
I want to talk about the U.S. response in a second. But first of all, what's being done within Latin America to deal with the crisis so far?
Perhaps the most important initiative is called the Lima Group. It's a group of 14 Latin American countries that was created a few months ago to have a unified voice against the Maduro regime. And it was held in Lima, Peru, and Latin American countries include Mexico, Brazil, Argentina, Peru, Colombia, Panama, Canada, not the U.S., but the U.S. obviously is also a leading force and against the Maduro regime. So that's perhaps the most important initiative that we have so far. The OAS, which is this regional multilateral organization based in Washington, is also is trying to increase pressure by their own means, but is lacking that strength. And that's why the Secretary General, Luis Almagro, is the one taking the lead in more in the individual basis than on the OAS as a whole. So that's type of the initiative we've seen from Latin America. We haven't seen sanctions yet from the major Latin American countries, except for Panama. Panama was the only country that has imposed sanctions so far besides North America. But my sense is that that's coming. For the first time, we've seen the Lima Group committed to increase pressure. And one of the ways to do is to start implementing sanctions and following the U.S. leadership on that sense.
Yeah, the U.S. has been obviously quite forceful. and have imposed sanctions. And what do you think about the U.S. approach so far?
The sanctions that the U.S. has imposed are important. They increase pressure, but they are not going to be enough. And that's a mantra that we have been discussing in the Washington community. What type of approach and what type of comprehensive approach sanctions need to have? And you really need a full approach. You need full strength. You need multilateral approaches. And that includes pushing the International Criminal Court to keep investigating Maduro for human rights abuses. That includes seizing assets that has been stolen from the Venezuelan people. And that includes we have a migration issue, so implementing protected status to all those migrants that are all over the world is important. And designing an exit ramp for most of their officials that are within the Maduro regime is an important tool. Diplomatic isolation needs to be done. So what I'm saying is that sanctions are very important to increase pressure. It's an important tool to divide the Maduro regime. But really, when it comes to the Venezuelan crisis, there is not a silver bullet. You need really a full approach. And that's where the sanctions needs to keep going, to that direction, having a more comprehensive approach than only just sanctioning. I have to say, however, sanctions have been done in two ways. Individual sanctions, the U.S. has sanctioned more than 60 officials so far, including President Maduro and his vice president, Tarek El-Aissami. But also, there has been economic sanctions that has been effective in terms of limiting the regime to issue new debt and get cash to finance its lawless activities in Venezuela. So in that sense, sanctions have really contributed to increase the pressure that is needed. But again, we need more, we need strength, we need multilateral, and that's where we all need to work together.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, kind of sums up the Trump administration's stance, and she said that Maduro has to go. Now, we talked about exit ramps a little there. If he was to go, would that solve the problem? And how could Venezuela then recover from there? What would recovery look like?
Venezuela is a collapsed country. You don't really have institutions working in Venezuela. There are not public services. There is a very important debt going on in Venezuela. You really need a full recovery process in Venezuela, like the ones that we seen in other countries like Afghanistan or other failed states. And Venezuela too is a failed state. So you really need a support. The role of the international community to help Venezuela during the day after is going to be crucial. And that's what I don't think that the level of engagement that the international community needs to have today is not there yet. And that's where I think we need to push on that direction. We need more involvement from the international community today and during the day after it as well. Of course, in the first phase of recovery of Venezuela, you are going to need humanitarian aid. There is, like we discussed, there is a severe humanitarian crisis going on. So you need aid in the first place. But also looking ahead, you need to develop the industries in Venezuela to make sure that the country is sustainable by itself and not depending on aid or any other or international assistance. I don't think a broke, illegitimate, isolated, unpopular regime is going to be enough to push Maduro out of power. You really need full pressures from abroad and inside of the country to have a regime change as the U.S. is pushing for. And that's not happening right now because there's no internal pressure. There's not an united opposition. There is no mobilizations on the streets in Caracas. Normally, when you have fraudulent elections like the one we saw in recent days, you have people protesting on the street. That is not happening in Venezuela. So, and that is needed if you want to see some sort of democratic transitions going on. But that's not happening, and that's concerning. And that's why, no matter how much pressure is coming from outside in terms of sanction and diplomatic isolation, the Venezuelan people need support inside as well. And that's a very concerning issue that I have.
Why do you think they're not on the streets? Is it just they're fed up?
It's a combination of multiple factors, including they are busy looking for food to put food on the table and medicine, but also there is not really a opposition that is channeling their anger, their frustration. So it's hard for the Venezuelan people to commit their lives and their time on to put their life on the street, for example. So it's hard.
And that was Moises Rendon bringing us to the end of our show for this week. If you're in the States, I hope you enjoy your Memorial Day weekend. And wherever you are, if you have anything you want to tell me or suggest about the show, you can reach me at cquinn@csis.org or find me on Twitter. That's it for me. I'm Colm Quinn. Thanks for listening.